I selflessly gave away my action figure to somebody.
Is that a coloring book?
Yes, it is. And it's autographed. Of course, every Patches pal has their checklist.
I would hope so. Maybe like we can start with you, Brenda, if you would just take out your checklist there and just read it off.
Mind mommy and daddy. Wash hands, face, neck, and ears. Drink milk. Eat all your food. Say your prayers. Hang up clothes. And then if you do all that, you can check the Patches pal on the card.
So Brenda Goldstein-Young works here at KPLU, and her really dear old friend Heidi Hansen is also here. What's a Patches pal, Heidi?
A Patches pal is someone who grew up with Patches, who followed the J.P. Patches checklist, and looked in their dryer on their birthday.
So I'm Gabriel Spitzer, you're listening to Sound Effect. Our theme today is As Seen on TV, and for generations of Seattleites and people in the area, J.P. Patches was a TV fixture. How would you just kind of describe a show? Like, what was it like for somebody who's never seen it?
You know, a lot of slapstick, a lot of crazy characters.
Well, Ketchikan the Animal Man promised to be here and take care of our purple fodder.
I know Heidi and I watched it probably way past when we really should have, you know, junior high and high school, but it was just so entertaining.
And of all the sort of clowns that there are, because there's a lot, he's kind of that scamp, like almost Chaplin-esque hobo clown.
Right. I took a friend's daughter. She was 6 years old at the time, and I was telling her about this TV clown I grew up with, and I think she had the expectation of Bozo. And I took her to see J.P. Patches, and she was scared to death. It was nothing but baby boomer adults there.
When you were kids, albeit older kids than would typically maybe tune into a clown show, like, what was it about him that you loved?
I love the adult humor. There's just nothing like him.
And this was before special effects. When I look back on YouTube at some of the episodes, how corny the special effects were, but the sound effects amazing.
Well, my favorite character was Gorst the Friendly Furple, who lived in the secret room below the city dump. And the only way you could get him out of there was to do the secret chant.
Ready? Zabba, 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 zoo.
Secret room, a la kazoo.
And then, ooka chaka, ooka, ooka, ooka chaka.
It was great.
I'm going to take a stab at like being a sociologist about this for a second, okay? There's something so specific about Patches and specific about the humor and also to a time and a place. And so now especially, it must be like a marker of having grown up in a particular time and place. And maybe a time and place when the Seattle area wasn't quite as cosmopolitan and happening as it is now.
Yeah, I think so.
It just is the feeling that takes me right back to my childhood.
Well, I want to thank number one Patches pals, Heidi Hansen and Brenda Goldstein-Young, for helping us kick off this edition of Sound Effect As Seen on TV. We're going to have tales of the power of television from around the region. That's coming up, so don't go away. Not too long ago, I was at a friend's house, and we found ourselves watching the show Hoarders.
The stove is piled up to where I cannot cook on it. The sinks are piled up to where I can't get even any water out of the sink.
This is not something I expected to do, necessarily. And in the past, I think I would have agreed with this review of the show that called it, quote, a lurid, desperate source of inspiration seasoned with voyeuristic sensationalism.
One night, she laid in the floor for an hour and a half. Due to the clutter, she wasn't able to get herself up until she finally inched her way to a nightstand and was able to get herself
now,
up.
Now, to tell you the truth, I actually found it to be a lot more subtle and compelling than all that. But I couldn't help but wonder, who comes up with this stuff? So now we have answers. Matt Chan comes up with this stuff. He lives in Seattle, and he founded Screaming Flea Productions. Chan has decades in the business and a really deep understanding of how television works. And that, he explained, started early.
Growing up, we didn't have much money. So when we finally inherited an old black and white television, that was a big event. I mean, I just watched it all the time. I would always stay up and watch Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show.
Here's Johnny!
What was it about Johnny Carson that connected with you?
I think because it was live, or theoretically live, but it was happening right then and there. And so you know that there's an immediate connection.
Beautiful. When I met him the first time, I followed him 2 blocks.
So what was the next step from that? Like, when did you get serious about it?
Well, in high school. It was during the Vietnam War, and, you know, there was all sorts of protests, and probably education was taking a backseat to most things. You know, in our high school, my English teacher decided, well, we're not going to teach English. We're going to teach filmmaking.
Did you have an idealism about either using it to do hard-hitting journalism or using it to make art?
It was more to make art. I was fascinated by the technology of it, you know, editing, putting music to things, looking at the timing.
Walk me through what took you from film school or wanting to make films to making modern reality television.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, film school was always tough to get in, no matter where you are, because everybody wants to be a filmmaker. So I was wandering around trying to get a film class, and there's this professor in broadcasting, and he says, you know, well, this is close to film. Why don't you come over here? So I said, you know, you're right. So I went there, and, you know, a lot of it was communication theory, you know, mass comm regulations, and some of it, and a small part of it, was production. But when I look at my career, the entirety of that has helped me, from running TV stations to actually how to construct stories.
What, like, give me a piece of that. What is one of the takeaways from what you learned in mass comm theory that you apply in storytelling?
There was this book, I can't even remember the book. It was called Striking a Responsive Chord, and that always stuck with me. And it's what I do in all my shows. First of all, you have to say something, show something that resonates with the viewer immediately. Because how many times have you picked up a book and read it, and, like, if the first paragraph doesn't get you, you're like, yeah, I'm not going to do this.
So many times.
So, yeah, I mean, that happens. Piece of music. Even a movie. James Bond movies are a perfect example. I mean, they jump into it immediately. And so you're hooked.
So let's bring it up to Hoarders. Why is this obscure-sounding idea for a show, why does it resonate with people?
It resonates with people because it's an emotional feeling that is almost universal. I would say is universal. The idea that objects hold emotional meaning, right? I mean, everyone has that keychain or the junk drawer that they throw stuff in. They look at it, they're like, wow, well, here's this can opener, but, you know, I got this on a trip and I like it. And it doesn't take up that much room. I'll leave it there. Now, Hoarders takes that to, like, you know, the thousandth degree of it, but it's the same feeling. So when you watch it, you get it. You get what those people are going through. You're empathetic.
So where did that idea come from? Did you come up with this idea?
Yeah.
How?
Well, my son was studying in Japan one year, and so my wife and I flew out to see him. And Japanese television is incredible because it is just crazy. And so there was this show that was sort of like a Good Morning America Today show, and it had this guy running around a Tokyo neighborhood that had very nice houses, but there was this one house that was just a mess. And I guess the literal translation was garbage house. So they brought in some people from the city, and they, you know, they started arguing with this guy, saying, you got to clean this mess up, you know, and he was nuts, and he fought him, and they cleaned it up, and there was all this, you know, rats, everything running around. And I thought to myself, like, there are houses in America like that. They're everywhere. So when I got back, I started doing research on it, and I found that there was this term called hoarding. And I said, okay, there's got to be a show in here. So we developed the idea a number of different ways. Some of the networks were interested in it. And so we finally settled on this one format, which is the current format of Hoarders. A&E, the network, didn't like it. They go, this won't work. But there was one programmer on the Biography Network who said, I love this show. So they put it on the Biography Channel with no promotion, and it popped a huge number. And so they ran it again, same thing. And probably within 3 shows, it was a phenomenon.
How do you keep the people on Hoarders from being cartoon characters?
We don't have them do anything other than be who they are. A lot of the scripted reality shows, you know, they'll take someone's personality and say, like, amp it up. But we don't do that because it's a dynamic of just people. And if they forget the cameras are there, they actually become so real. And that's when people recognize this is real stuff. And that's what engages them.
And can you think of like a, one of those human moments that you made a point of keeping because it deepened somebody and it made them more than just a freak?
Yeah, there was what, and I can't remember what episode, but it got down to where this older lady, and the conflict was she wouldn't clean her house, so her daughter could never bring her kids there. So this grandmother never got to see her grandchildren. And it got to the point where she demanded, like, you got to choose. It's either us or your stuff. And the woman chose her stuff. And that was just shocking because, wow, can you imagine that, picking your garbage over your grandkids?
Well, how do you respond to people who just say this is exploitative?
I respond to them truthfully. I say, yeah, it is exploitive.
There you go.
You know, because it is. I mean, it wouldn't be good reality television if it wasn't. Now, how we do it, I think, makes a difference. There's other shows that knocked off hoarders where they would actually pay hoarders to be on the show. I mean, to me, that's like paying an alcoholic in alcohol. What we always did in Hoarders was provide aftercare, cleanup services. So we took care of the people that were on the show. They were never paid. But how we got them on the show was they were at a crisis point. They were either going to lose a family member, they were going to have their house condemned. I mean, there was always some reason that they were at a crisis. The other shows where they pit one group against another to get a prize, I think is horrendous.
To what extent are you at peace with the fact that on your professional obituary, it's going to say creator of Hoarders? That's going to be the first thing, and maybe a good chunk of it beyond that. Are you cool with that?
I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
Because it goes back to what I said, what I learned in college, and that was striking a responsive chord. And to me, Hoarders is a show that validates that whole theory of how you capture an audience.
Well, Matt Chan is founder of Screaming Flea, which is a Seattle-based production company, and these days he does consulting work and some independent projects as well. Thank you so much for coming on Sound Effect, Matt.
Thank you.
It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This week, our theme is As Seen on TV. And this next story is a little strange. It's about something you may have seen on screen, and it was almost seen on TV, thanks to the eccentric vision of a particular Seattle prankster. Sound Effect senior producer Arwin Nix picks up the tale.
Writer Cameron Crowe is famous for movies like Jerry Maguire, Almost Famous, Say Anything. But a lesser-known work of Crowe's is the early 1990s movie Singles.
You got 20 numbers of 20 girls that you will never call, never go out with, never see in the daylight. 20 numbers that exist only to make you feel like a guy who can go out and get 20 numbers.
Hey, watch the volume.
Sorry, tinnitus.
Club disease. Ah, you kids are all gonna be deaf.
The basic idea of the movie is that the lives of all these characters in this single apartment building intersect. They are singles, and the movie is about dating.
No, you just wait for me to meet them and then go make popcorn.
I will make popcorn with whomever I want to.
You've made popcorn with half of the city!
Yeah, well, at least I don't have to chase the popcorn.
It came out in 1992, and it is very 1992. In it, you see notable Northwest musicians like Eddie Vedder and Stone Gossard, among others. It's self-aware.
Talking here with Cliff Pontier. Cliff, any comments on the Seattle sound and Citizen Dick's place in it?
Well, I don't like to reduce us just as being part of the Seattle sound. I like to think of us as expanding more. Like, we're huge in Europe right now. I mean, we've got records, a big record just broke in Belgium. Into
the
blood again.
The movie was shot in Seattle, much of it at the Coryell Court apartment building up on Capitol Hill, also known as the Singles Apartments.
I mean, when you move into the Singles apartment building, you know what you're getting into. You're moving into like a, you know, a city landmark. Honestly, it's like moving into the Smith Tower and then saying, get away from my Smith Tower.
That's Derek Erdman. He's a local artist. His works are on display all over town. Enormous paintings of Seattle sports figures adorn the walls of the 95 Slide Sports Bar. His portraits of authors hang in the cafe in the corner of the Elliott Bay Book Company. He doesn't live in the Singles building, but Althea Jones, her partner Elliot Bonnet, and their five-month-old daughter do.
In like the 5 minutes I've been here, three different people have stopped to take pictures in front of the building, and your window faces right where they are posing. How often do you see this happening?
Really, really regularly. Like if I'll sit here for a half an hour, I see somebody usually.
So every day?
Yeah. Oh yeah, every day.
Is there like any common thread between these singles tourists?
No, all across the board. Like punks, yuppies, old people, young people. It's really interesting. Sometimes I look at these people and I think, how, why? Why do you like this movie?
It might be going too far to call the movie Singles beloved, but it is at least beliked. In June of this year, Derek had an idea. He was going to bring a TV VCR combo to the courtyard of the Singles apartment building and watch the movie. He made a Facebook event for the night. It was called Watching Singles at the Singles House.
And it stemmed from, I live in an apartment that has a courtyard and we were recently watching movies in the courtyard. This is such a nostalgic town that it just seemed to make sense. It struck me as such a funny idea right away to meld those two things together.
He invited 700 people.
I don't know. I wanted everyone to know about it.
Derek could only invite 700 people, but those people invited their friends who invited their friends. Full disclosure, I was one of the people that RSVP'd. The Seattle Weekly then interviewed Derek about the event, and more people RSVP'd. At one point, more than 2,000 people were invited.
It was an idea that I had no plan for.
Another thing that Derek didn't have was permission. He didn't know anyone that lived in the building, though he told the Seattle Weekly that he did.
There was never anybody in the building that he knew or that he ran into casually and asked about this. He lied.
The landlord told the residents of the building that anyone who helped Derek with this event would be evicted. Up the stairs from Althea's place lives Kyle Jenkins.
I found out about it through my wife, who found out about it from our neighbor, who found out about it from a friend at work, who found out about it on Facebook.
The day before more than 1,400 people were set to swarm the courtyard of this iconic building, Kyle was one of the many residents that wrote to Derek asking him to cancel. I asked both Derek and Kyle about this exchange.
Hey man, I live in the Singles building and wrote that post recently that you removed.
I may have removed a post. I may have removed it a couple times. I want to reach out directly and explain I'm not trying to be a dick.
I just want you and the people that are thinking of going to know that the people that live in the building really aren't cool with it and see it as complete violation of their privacy and even safety.
This isn't an issue of some authoritarian power manager or owner. It's the residents themselves. God, see, now I feel terrible. This is a great message. So I'm probably getting this along with...
Derek and Kyle went back and forth with these messages. Derek first postponed the event and then eventually added canceled to the title.
That's the end of his message.
The night that the event was supposed to happen, Derek drove to the apartment building. He dropped off his TV VCR combo and his VHS copy of Singles. He taped a note to the TV that read, "R.I.P. Singles Night," with a sad face drawn on it. But he didn't actually take down the Facebook page.
I didn't want it to die. I'll be honest with you. I love it. It's like a kid at this point. It's like I created this thing. It made so many people happy. And for it to just go away, I didn't want that to happen. So every time the date is about to happen, I change it to a month later so I can get one more month.
And in some ways, he couldn't understand the level of pushback that he got with this.
I can't fathom being that offended by something. If somebody did that to my apartment building and I live on the first floor, I think it was a riot. I think there are some people who can just take jokes better.
This is not Derek's first joke. Another nostalgic prank he pulled was when Derek made a fake Craigslist ad posing as Kurt Cobain's old roommate. He was selling some of Kurt Cobain's old stuff, like his skis.
You know, I made it on a whim because I thought it was funny. And I've always been a person who, if you get an idea, you should do it. Because there's so many people who say, oh, that'd be a good idea, but I'm too busy watching True Blood on DVD. Do a thing and see what happens, you know? Like, that's what life is made of, I think.
A local news station came to interview him. And though he donned his grungiest flannel, the reporter knew at first glance that it was a joke. Derek Erdman is much too young to have ever lived with Kurt Cobain.
I would say even that was pretty divisive. There were a lot of people that said, like, oh, this is so stupid. Who would do this? And who would do that?
When it comes to singles night, Kyle Jenkins thinks that Derek was playing a joke on everyone, playing a joke on a rapidly growing city's desperate craving for community, with no regard for the residents or for the more than 1,000 people that became part of this strange online world. And I asked Derek why he does this kind of stuff. What pushes him to prank?
I don't want to talk about that. I mean, that's nothing I want to examine. I don't think there's a problem. I went to bed last night happy that I'm divisive. Happy that, like, I think one day I can write some kind of book, some kind of list of, look at all these things that happened in my life. Look at all these things that I caused. I love a good prank.
Since Derek and I spoke, he has ceased moving the date of the event. It now lives in the graveyard of calendar events past on Facebook. People have stopped commenting, stopped sharing their memories of the movie, their pictures. But tourists continue to sit on the steps of the singles apartment building and have their photo taken. Althea and Kyle can watch from their windows. And you can see the evidence of the event that never happened. On the pillars that flank the stairs going up to the apartments, two signs now live. One reads, private property, and the other says, no trespassers.
Sound Effects Senior Producer, Arwin Nix. Hey, welcome back. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to KPLU, and this week it's Sound Effect as Seen on TV. So we're all nerds these days, right? Business people and football players and even the governor of Michigan have proudly used that term. But don't forget, nerd used to have a pretty negative connotation, and it definitely conjured up a very specific image. That picture comes in large part from the movies and TV of the 1980s, and one of the people we have to thank for that is Northwest actor and pioneering dweeb, Tom Bray. And when I talked to him, he spelled out what a typical Tom Bray character from that era might have looked like.
Well, he'd be wearing a bow tie, sometimes a corduroy jacket, or a sweater vest. And glasses, of course, glasses.
This is sort of moving in a very particular direction, isn't it?
I would say so, yes. I would say, dare we say nerd.
Well, let's talk about one of the most prominent nerds that you played, if I may take the liberty of calling him that. Boz from Riptide. Could you describe Riptide for people who were maybe not born yet in the 1984 when it came out?
It was about three guys who lived on a boat who were detectives. And Joe Penny and Perry King were the two macho guys. And I played a character named Murray Boz Baczynski, who was a computer genius and who kind of acted as the brains for the organization.
You got the name of that boat that they were on, didn't you?
Yeah. The Riptide.
And sometimes for, I guess, Steven's amusement, he would get me involved in action. So I remember in one episode, he put an Uzi in my hand. A few days later, I receive as a gift from him this gigantic poster of me shooting an Uzi with the caption, Macho Geek.
Listen, one of us is going to have to stay on the boat. That way we cover both sides, right?
Okay.
Yeah. Uh-oh. I know who that's going to be. Old no physical action Baczynski, right? I'm going to stay here with my computers while you two guys stake out the hotel, right?
I don't think so, Murray. I think we're going to need you at the hotel. Huh? Murray. Listen, that could be dangerous.
Great!
Well, you were really a pioneer in being a macho geek or a geek of any kind on TV because, I mean, this was before Urkel. This was way before something like The Big Bang Theory. This was even before the Revenge of the Nerds movies, which is how I learned what a nerd was. I wondered what examples you had. Like, where did you get that look and the personality?
Well, that's easy because my brother-in-law was a software engineer for Atari. He was a game designer. And a lot of my inspiration came from the guys that he hung around with who designed video games. Guys with broken glasses who basically were living and sleeping in the corporate offices and didn't have time to fix their glasses.
And how much of that stuff jibes with your own personality and your own look?
Well, I think quite a lot. The bow tie, for example. Boz didn't wear bow ties, but I had been wearing since I was a young actor in the 70s in New York City doing commercials. I remember I was dating a girl at the time whose father was vice president of Cessna Airlines, and he always wore a bow tie. And I thought that that was rather odd. And I said to him, Bob, what's with the bow tie? And he said, well, when they can't remember my name, they remember that guy in the bow tie. I started doing that, and it worked. I started booking commercials left and right, and I became known as that guy who auditions in a bow tie.
What happened after your heyday of 1980s roles? I mean, you were in some pretty big series, and then you transitioned into writing, and then what happened next?
Yeah, I think between the series and my transition to writing were some film roles just about every film I did, I died a terrible death.
Any favorite deaths?
Probably Prince of Darkness, where I was run through with a bicycle, half a rusty bicycle, I might add, by Alice Cooper. And you know, it's not every day that you can say that.
Wow.
And then came writing.
And then after 2001, you kind of got out of television, it seems like.
I did, and that was, a lot of that had to do with 9/11. 9/11 made it very difficult to travel. And the final analysis, it was a balance of family and career. I'm grateful that I got out when I did.
And tell us about what you got into.
There was a 60 Minutes story about a guy that taught television. And, you know, would you believe this man teaches television? So I watched this with great fascination, and I called him up. I found him at Syracuse, and I said, I want to do what you do. I don't know when, and I don't know how, but I do. And he said, well, when the time comes, call me. And so we kept in touch, and the time came, and I called him, and he kind of navigated me through, you know, the ivory tower. And so I've been at Portland State for over 10 years teaching television studies. And then along the way, I liked teaching, so I went back to school and got my teaching credential, and I teach drama to 1,000 middle school students.
Wow. So thinking for a moment about the college classes that you teach and the television studies work that you do, has learning how to see TV from an analytical or critical point of view changed the way that you look at some of your own work and even the work before you were a writer? Like, how would you read Riptide now as compared with at the time?
Well, I would read it as slow and and just like most 80s television. I mean, anything pre-Miami Vice, it moves at a snail's pace.
Well, for that reason and others probably, I mean, I hope you'll forgive me for saying this, but Riptide looks kind of dated these days. Would you agree?
Sure. So yes.
And some of the other stuff from that era looks like it's from that era. And I'm just curious whether your students, like now I'm thinking about your middle schoolers, right? Your 6th, 7th, 8th graders, whether any of them ever come across that stuff or go out and seek it out and talk to you about it and what they make of it.
I will show them an episode on occasion. And it makes for a good conversation about, first of all, about technology and how technology has changed, because Riptide was pre-internet. That brings up a kind of a hilarious discussion of what how far technology has come. And then also the pace at which we lived in the 80s. There is value in that discussion. But all in all, when all is said and done, they think it's cool.
And they're also seeing, you know, what the nerd persona looked like back then, which is very different now, right? I mean, being a nerd is kind of cool, and a nerd certainly looks a lot different now, I think, than the stereotype of a nerd from the 1980s. Nowadays, it might just be...
Except that I have to laugh when my kids come into my classroom wearing nerd glasses. And by nerd glasses, I mean they go to 3D movies, and they'll take the glasses home, and they'll punch the lenses out, and they'll put tape on the sides, and then they'll come in wearing these glasses as a fashion statement, having no idea that I was on television in 1982 doing the same thing when nobody was doing it.
Tom Bray teaches television studies at the college level in Portland, as well as drama to middle school students, and he has a lot of acting credits, including Boz Buzinski from Riptide in the mid-1980s. Thank you so much, Tom, for talking to us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Welcome back to Sound Effect on KPLU. Gabriel Spitzer here. It's As Seen on TV this week. And if you've ever woken up to a mystery, maybe some kind of strange object in your yard or an act of overnight vandalism, and you don't know how it got there, well, this next story is for you. We are going to introduce you to a woman in Seattle who put up some cameras to keep an eye on her cats. And the cameras run day and night. In person, you know, her neighborhood seems quiet, but as seen on TV, it is not. Here's KPLU's Ed Ronco.
Hey! How are you?
Come on in.
Chris Sujikawa and her family have four cats. There's Binky, a 19-year-old with arthritis who doesn't like getting her hair combed. Cleo is 10 already, just like Max. That's Max. He loves dry food and people, but sometimes starts fights with other cats. And then there's 9-year-old Simon.
He was a feral kitten that I adopted from the shelter. He was climbing up those steps. I was going, oh, cool, he can climb up a ladder. And then the next thing I know, he's like up in that top window, and he just jumps over to our neighbor's garage. And then that was the last I saw of him.
After posting flyers and knocking on doors and wondering whether she might ever find Simon, Chris and her family finally installed closed-circuit cameras. A survey done by the ASPCA says 85% of the cats and dogs lost in this country are recovered eventually, and the cameras backed up those statistics.
One of my friends said that, oh, he's long gone. He's not coming back. But then, sure enough, like at 3 or 4 in the morning, I'd see him creeping around in our backyard.
With no way to get back in the house. Eventually, they trapped Simon and got him back inside, but the cameras stayed up, and they added catios. He said catio.
Yeah, outdoor cat patio.
These are pretty nice accommodations for cats.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I love them. And so this is, it's like an 11-foot outdoor play area for the cats.
The catios are like those playscapes you see in front of a McDonald's. It's a big kiddie playground, platforms and ledges for them to sit on, sometimes stretching up to the second floor, encompassed by what looks like a giant birdcage. And all of it, the property and the cats, are under the watchful eye of 8 closed circuit cameras.
The feral cat just goes from one catio to the other, to back and forth. And so during the day, no wonder he's sleeping because he's up all night.
The cameras now capture anything that moves on her property. The cats, me.
There you are, if you want.
Oh my God, is that how I walk? And along this quiet tree-lined street in Wallingford, it turns out, a rash of property crime.
I've seen cars get stolen, or 2 cars, or the same car actually, but I've seen it stolen twice. And someone break into our car, and I've seen a couple steal some trash from our garbage.
The car prowl happened just recently. On a laptop at her kitchen table, Chris pulls up the footage.
I could speed it up if you want.
The car is parked in the driveway. It is the middle of the night, and all of a sudden, there is a woman standing next to the driver's side door.
Okay, well, she looks like a Caucasian female with glasses and a ponytail and wearing a love pink sweatshirt. She seems like she's medium frame. She does have a flashlight. She's not using it right now because the dome light's on, so she can see really well into our car.
This is not a smash and grab. The woman has the door open and is kneeling on the seat.
And then she's very careful.
She lifts up the center console and puts some of its contents on the passenger side. When she's done, she closes the door as quietly as possible and then gives it a little bump with her hip to make sure it's shut. The dome light gently fades.
This is a very thorough car prowl.
Yes, now she opened the back door.
Where she's joined by a man who had been waiting just off camera.
He's shirtless. It was hot that day, I think. Let's see.
We watch and watch as they comb through the car. Chris says they were meticulous, but the only thing missing was a painkiller pill she had in one of the compartments.
You know, they could have just really made a mess. And so I appreciate that they didn't steal, you know, things that had value to me, like my sunglasses or my prescription glasses.
They still broke into your car. I mean, you appreciate that they were nice about it, but...
Yeah, that's true. But I'd appreciate if they could respect people's property and not do that. Or, even better, I wish that they had the resources or in whatever way so they wouldn't have to feel like they'd have to steal from other people.
The police came and watched the tape, and Chris handed over a copy as evidence. Now, the video has not led to an arrest or even identification of the suspects, but it has helped Chris understand what happened to her car. Still, she says it's also a little creepy to watch someone go through your stuff.
They know so much more information about us than we know about them. We have no idea like where they live, what their names are, what their address is, what their hobbies are, because they can tell by our bowling balls that we're bowlers.
But mostly, having a network of cameras around the house has been a window into a universe that few of us really get to see.
I feel like some people might look at video footage like this and be like, I would just rather not know.
I want to know.
She wants to know that it was a crow that left the fox's foot she found in her yard one morning, or that it was a drunk guy who stole her Halloween decoration. That package from Amazon was taken from the porch, not lost in shipping. And knowing that someone went through her garbage brought her closer to her neighbors. She warned them about possible identity theft on the block, and one of the neighbors found the trash in his can down the street.
At least that was nice. See, that was another considerate thing. They didn't just, like, throw it on the ground or, like, a wee and just, you know, throw it on the lawn. Because
you really see the best in thieves, don't you?
I try to, because it's like I am so thankful. Because that's another thing, too, is I totally understand that it is a property crime. It's just stuff. Like, burglary would be different.
You mean entering your house?
Yeah, entering your house. That is much more.
That's the line.
Yeah, that's the line, yeah.
So she's thankful they didn't do more harm, didn't steal their identities, didn't really steal their stuff. But she still called the police.
It gave me a peace of mind because, like I said, it just happened within 2 weeks, two different things. It was just like, wow, is our house next?
It is in those instances when something happens, when the cat gets lost or the car gets prowled, that Chris says she's happy to have the cameras to be able to take a look and solve the mystery.
There he is. Okay, here we go.
KPLU's Ed Ronco. Sound Effect comes to us from senior producer Arwin Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad. Ed Whiskers Ronco contributed this week, and thanks to our faithful intern, Bree Ripley.
Hello, Gabriel.
Hey, Arwin Nix, senior producer Arwin Nix.
So I just wanted to underline the thank you to Brianna Ripley. She has done a wonderful job as our first official Sound Effect intern. We wish her nothing but the best of luck in her career, and I do not doubt that she will be all of our boss one day.
Stay out of trouble, Ripley. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. We get web help from Mike Lewis. Hey, meet you back here next week for Amateur Hour.
I don't know how to speak like an artist. I don't know what the definition of an artist is. I don't buy that I'm an artist yet. I absolutely needed that kind of validation.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.